Hello, and welcome to A Good Science Read with me, Professor Frances Ashcroft. My guest today is the developmental psychologist, Professor Dame Uta Frith. She is an emeritus professor in cognitive development at the Institute of Cognitive Neuroscience at University College London and a fellow of the Royal Society. She has a special interest in autism and dyslexia and pioneered much of the key research into these brain conditions. She's won many awards for her work, and her book, Autism, Explaining the Enigma, provided the first account of what happens inside the mind of a patient with autism. Uta, welcome to A Good Science Read. The book we're discussing today is Our Brains, Ourselves by Masoud Hossain. Masoud is a neurologist and a professor of cognitive neuroscience at the University of Oxford, and this is his first popular science book. It's a beautifully written account of the stories of seven of his patients whose personal and social identities were deeply affected by their neurological conditions. He shows how their different conditions have illuminated our understanding of how our brains work and how they generate our sense of self. What particularly attracted you to this book, Uta?
Well, I am a great fan of case studies. And like many other people, I enjoyed reading the books by Oliver Sacks. And I have to say, when I came across Masoud Hossain's book, I thought, gosh, this is just what I wanted to read. It is better than Oliver Sacks in many ways. It is real up-to-date neuroscience that we learn about. And it is told in this wonderful narrative way, so that each case that he discusses, there are seven cases, reveals something new and often surprising about the brain. He really asks this very deep question of what makes us who we are. Can we get to the self through the study of the brain?
Yes, so I agree with you, actually, that this is probably better than A Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. He seems to me to be a far more compassionate writer. And the science is, as you mentioned, so much more up to date, so that it becomes possible to determine what some of the brain regions actually are doing. So as you say, there are seven of these cases, so maybe we can look at each of them in turn, at least briefly. And the first one completely fascinated me because I had never heard of this. It was about a highly motivated extrovert young man who suddenly lost all his sense of motivation. He had a small stroke from which he appeared to recover completely, in that he could walk and talk normally, but he just couldn't be bothered to do anything. I'd never heard of such a case. And it was really unfortunate because he lost his job and then he couldn't be bothered to apply for Social Security, so he had no money, so he moved in with very nice friends. But they got fed up with him after a while because he simply couldn't be bothered to take a shower or do the washing up or anything. He didn't even turn up for his first meeting with Masoud.
Yes, I think it is absolutely fascinating to read about this young man who had apparently this very minor stroke, tiny, tiny stroke, but on two sides of the basal ganglia deep down in the brain. And it certainly seemed only a few days for him to recover walking and talking and all of these things. But these strokes left some terrible, terrible consequences for him. So really deep in the brain, this is a very unusual case when you get nothing else happening, but you can sort of localize what the effect is of what happens in that part of the brain. And it really has to do with motivation to do anything at all. Or to look at it in another way, it's what Masoud identifies as a lost sensitivity to reward, you know, the reward of doing something. And which resulted in indeed a complete change of personality, to go from a much loved member of a group of friends who would do his, share of what needed to be done if you would, be a good friend, to somebody who just couldn't do anything and really fell into a kind of state of
apathy.
Now, what's so nice about this case study is, of course, that actually there was a treatment.
Wonderful, wasn't it? What was so fascinating about that was, I don't think Mustard had seen any cases like this before, but because he knew that motivation actually involved the dopamine reward circuits,
that's right,
he thought perhaps there would be less dopamine. And so he used something which bound to the dopamine receptors to stimulate the activity at that particular region of the brain. And it was transformative.
Yeah. It is beautifully described how it was very... He was very careful to introduce this, because there are, of course, always side effects and unknown side effects, even in cases like this. But he looked back at cases of Parkinson's, where you also get some kind of lack of motivation, and the treatment that you have for Parkinson's disease is what he first started this particular man on. And it didn't at first actually work. So he had to go to a second additional dopamine active treatment, which seemed to really make a big difference. So this extra thing acted on the receptors of the nerve cells that bind the dopamine. And it was very experimental. I think he describes how very careful he was in case it didn't work or in case it had some other terrible effects. But it was wonderful and lovely to read when he says that when he saw this man again after some months, and I met him in the waiting room, he couldn't even recognize him. He was, completely shaven. He had been completely neglecting himself before. He was dressed properly. He was the person he used to be to some extent.
Yes, he now had a job in finance. He had his own flat.
And even a girlfriend.
Extraordinary, isn't
it? Yes, it is extraordinary. And
I loved what he said about this case. He said, David proved to be a turning point in my life and research. Living proof it was possible to transform people. I think it is the most wonderful story.
It is. And it is indeed also something that tells us how little we still know about the causes of apathy. It is a symptom that in here it occurred in total isolation of everything else. But it is very, very often the case that you find this in dementia. And it is really rather one of the sort of worst features. I think he says somewhere that it's easy to forgive your spouse when they forget things, but it's not easy to forgive them if they just never do any bit of housework when they need to be reminded to even, wash themselves. That's much, much worse than perhaps memory loss.
And this is one of the things we can come back to later, but you don't just lose your personal identity. You also lose your place in society, lose your social identity because of what's happened to your brain. And what was lovely in this case was David was able to re-establish his connections with all his friends and family.
Yeah, that is a sort of a wonderful narrative that starts out the book. We have to say, though, not all his cases have such a very happy ending.
The next one is rather sad. This one is the one where the person completely lost their semantic memory. I had no idea what this was, but I understand it's the ability to understand the names of objects and what they're for.
But it's much more than the names of objects. It's really knowledge of the world. It's really understanding that there is a hierarchical structure to concepts, that you're not just losing names, you're losing
the understanding of what these things do.
The world around you. And it is a gradual thing. So you notice this slipping away. In this particular patient, it clearly was very difficult at first when he came as a patient to understand what he was complaining about, because he talked fluently, articulately, and he seemed to be completely impressive, so that you thought, what on earth can be wrong with his memory? And in fact, it took quite a while, like a detective, I think, to suddenly find out that he didn't understand the meaning, what a lawnmower was. He just, obviously, in the course of the conversation, this turned out to be an absolute, abyss. Suddenly, you realize that was more than not remembering the name of that particular instrument. And he didn't know what a rake was for either. And he couldn't draw it. That is the other thing. And when he was asked to produce some drawings of some animals, which we have a picture of, and you can see how incredibly impoverished
they exactly. are. I think it's also fascinating because he describes then how we think that words and concepts are represented in the brain.
In the temporal lobe, in the left temporal lobe in particular. And that is a vulnerable site for certain dementias to start to attack, as it were. And he talks about this, how they can really, in this particular case, he could see this shrinking of the temporal lobe, which is, of course, very dramatic.
Yes, using these brain scans.
Yes, yes.
But the other thing that was interesting was it wasn't just knowledge of objects. It was also some concepts, because he lost his sense of humour, because he could no longer understand what the words meant.
So he also then started to avoid being in groups with other people, because he couldn't actually follow their conversations anymore. And also, I think his family found it very difficult to comprehend how deep his problems were and how they were getting worse and worse. And that is a very sad thing to realize, that you have a degenerative disorder. You can't really stop it. And there was nothing that he could actually do for him, even so he tried to a little bit to give some kind of treatment. But
it's tragic.
It is very, very sad. And there isn't a treatment really available for this particular condition.
For me, in addition to the story of the patient, the understanding, the increased understanding that these patients' cases can bring to how the brain works is particularly interesting.
It is.
And I had no idea. One of the things that Hossein says is that representation of living objects may actually be stored separately from inanimate ones.
Yes, this is one of the most remarkable findings in neuropsychology, that made us understand that the brain is really what somebody called a society of minds. It is quite specialized, and if you lose particular bits, other bits are still there. So this is very relevant to our understanding of how the brain produces self, the sense of self, that it can still operate even if there are bits, very important bits, missing, deteriorated. But they are very specific. This is very clear that it's not all the same sort of thing.
Even I think the sense of self is not entirely lost in people with Alzheimer's disease, which I found rather surprising, because I thought that memory was really essential for one's sense of self, but apparently not.
In all the cases discussed in this book, it is quite clear that the self was not lost, it was changed. Mm. Something was lost, And other people around the patients noticed very much the changes. But this sense of self, the continuity of it, still seemed to remain, even with very, very bad brain damage.
I think for me, the most worrying disease he discusses is, of course, Alzheimer's, because we're all terrified of getting that ourselves. He speaks about a woman who slowly lost her memory, eventually not even knowing who her husband was. In fact, confusing him with a non-existent lover.
Yes, confabulating.
Yes.
So this is a very interesting story which illuminates what memory, you know, is actually like. It's not a video that you replay or a record that you can listen to. It is always a reconstruction. It needs a lot of work, a lot of inference. And if you lose cells in the hippocampus, this is a particular part of the brain that has been long been known to be very crucial for memory. When you lose some of this, you cannot properly reconstruct true memory. So you start confabulating. You mix memories together that really were apart. And you can't also imagine the future. That's another part of this system that allows us to reconstruct our place in life, our place in our group, who the other people are around us. Now, this was the story of a woman who started being ill with Alzheimer's in her 50s, really, really horribly early in life. And of course, the family had no idea that is what she could be suffering from. And they actually were very annoyed at her about her confabulations and her. She wasn't worried about her lack of memory, actually. She always said, everybody can forget. And she seemed to be quite possibly unaware of what was going on with her, which was one of the big stumbling blocks in this whole whole case study. And only at the end was it resolved, when she not only had shown some awareness of really how bad her state was, but she also almost admitted to deliberately having tried to project a different persona to her family, denying that there was anything wrong.
That's sort of understandable, though, isn't it?
Yes.
We don't want to imagine that this is happening to us.
Yes, yes.
I think I was very interested in this business of false memories. And I was trying to think myself about whether I had any false memories. And actually, I do have one that must absolutely be false. Because when I was I have a memory of being a small child, probably about 3 or 4, and looking out of my bedroom window at night and seeing this huge great owl sitting on the window ledge, staring into the room. That cannot be true. The window ledge would not have been large enough to accommodate an owl, and it certainly wouldn't have sat there. But I can see it, even now, in my mind's eye, quite vividly. So this is a story I must have told to myself, and which has now become a false memory. So it's easy to see how these things happen.
This is a very nice story. I like it very much. I think we all have something like that. It often has to do with distant child memories and how they are being translated. But there is another side to these false memories in court cases, when witnesses have to be interrogated. And I think here also Masoud Hussein goes into some details of the research that's being done to really indicate how suggestible we are. just the phrasing of certain questions can lead you to build up, to construct certain memories, which you will then repeat, and they will almost reinforce themselves. So this is very, very important to know. In that has real practical consequences in court cases, and it tells us very much that healthy people too can't totally rely on their memories.
I sometimes wonder whether some of that is whether we were focusing, whether our attention was not sufficient when we saw what was happening. For example, I'm sure you've seen this too, but there is a famous movie of two teams, a red and a blue team, playing a game of basketball. And you are asked to watch this film and count how many goals each team scores. And at the end of it, instead of you first get asked how many goals each team scored, and then the person who's running the experiment says to you, but actually that's not what I was interested in. How many of you saw the gorilla? And when the film was replayed, you saw that a man in a gorilla suit came into the middle of the game and beat his chest several times and walked off. I had not seen the gorilla.
Yes.
And I couldn't believe.
It's a famous experiment. And really, I think it illustrates so vividly how we are not perceiving without making inferences, without focusing on particular points that, you know, we take from the context, or we are led by the questions that we are being asked. So it is all, of course, to do with a sort of limited capacity that we have to take in what's around us. It's just too much. We have to be selective.
I think it would be awful, actually, if you remembered exactly everything.
Yeah.
If you could say precisely what you saw and were doing at a particular time on a particular day, your brain must be too full.
Yeah. That's absolutely right. There are actually some interesting case studies of this possibly happening, but not in this book, so we shouldn't really...
The next one he talks about is a different sort of dementia, a poor man who suffered visual hallucinations. And this was quite extraordinary because he would wake up in the middle of the night and be aware that there were people in the room with him, but they were not real. And he was afraid he was going mad and that he was going to be locked up.
Yes, indeed. It's again showing that what happens in the brain can be very, very specific. You know, he was perfectly able to act as a bus driver. Although things became a little bit difficult when the invisible people started to appear to him even while he was driving the bus. And that's when he really had to go to see a neurologist. And lucky that he did. Very lucky that he did. And I think that case study, as well as I think all of them, also show how really wonderful the NHS is. And how, you know, a consultant like Masood Hussein and his students leave no stone unturned. They're absolutely incredible at following traces, at accommodating to people, even if these people are hardly aware of how difficult they are. And in this particular case, there was a great resistance, I think, in the patient and his family to think this is something real. They rather denied that it happened. But it is a kind of dementia, a different kind. It has to do with a build-up of Lewy bodies in the frontal cortex, probably. And it gets worse. That is the problem. It gets worse and worse. So this bus driver, who was of Pakistani origin, felt that his family really shunned him and his friends as well. They couldn't explain why he behaved as he did, and he withdrew also from them. So his social connections suffered tremendously.
I think it's because in those cultures that he belongs to, hallucinations are thought to indicate that you're possessed by an evil spirit, like a djinn.
Yes, that was it. That was it. It was very seriously the thought of
madness.
Of madness, and that you really, which would lead inevitably to you being locked up.
Yes, and that all of this was a punishment from God, which is also horrible, really.
Yeah,
and I think that one of the things that came across there, I think, also is what you were referring to before about the fact that when we see things, we basically don't see everything, and we make assumptions about things.
Yeah, that's
not looking at a photograph or a video. So if we infer erroneous things about the environment, then this can result in hallucinations, and that's probably what happened here. Because his brain had trouble processing the visual input.
Yeah, this is really, really important for us to understand how we see, how we perceive, and how we generate, actually, we represent what we see in the outside world. And it's very clearly important that we know what our prior expectations are. We see what we expect to see. That's when you were talking about that experiment with the gorilla walking.
We don't expect to see it.
You really, really wouldn't expect that.
But it had a happy outcome, because at least for some time, a small amount of acetyl, boosting the acetylcholine in a particular region of the brain, caused them to vanish.
Yeah, I think that was another little miracle.
Yes.
That one should really celebrate. It made an enormous difference to this man and his family. They didn't at first believe that there was anything happening when he was administered very small doses of this treatment. But increasing it a little bit actually had the desired effect. And it really was due to this boosting levels of acetylcholine in the brain. So this is all to do with connections of nerves to each other, and it is really encouraging, I think, that even in such a case, it is not hopeless.
No, although in some cases it is,
and it would have been still very likely that after a time, the treatment would not have been sufficient, however high the doses is, to combat the deterioration of the brain that would happen with this particular kind of dementia.
The next case is about a small stroke in the right parietal lobe, which had the extraordinary consequence of the loss of awareness in the left visual field. So this man was suddenly found walking in the street as if he was drunk, and he kept bumping into things, which he couldn't see because he was totally unaware of what was going on on one side of him, on the left. Yes.
Yeah. It's very, very interesting and an incredibly compassionately described case. He's a West Indian man who had a nice group of friends who, at first, I think, they stood very much by him. They tried to lead him, especially one good friend. But they also somehow felt there was something really wrong with him and possibly
syphilis,
and they were really actually afraid of catching it from him. Again, you know, ideas that very understandable in society, and they really thought it couldn't be a stroke, because they knew what people might be like who had a stroke. They couldn't walk, they couldn't talk, and this man was actually perfectly able to walk and to talk. He was just neglecting completely, visually not being aware of the world on one side of him.
And it is very interesting, this selective attention that we have, this ability to process the relevant information. In his case, of course, he was He was just unaware of it all. So let's look at the last case now, which yes. I think was one of the most fascinating. And this was a young woman who found that her hand or leg on one side of her body would behave completely autonomously. And she would suddenly find that she was clutching their thigh.
Yes.
And she had no idea that her hand had done this, which resulted in all sorts of difficult situations, including being arrested by the police for harassment.
Yes.
And so Masood was rang up and asked if he would vouch for her, for the patient, that she had a problem.
And
it was very interesting, wasn't it? Because it was caused not by degeneration in this case, but by a small cyst pressing on a particular bit of the brain.
And the cyst probably resulted from a trauma where she was actually attacked when she was, you know, still much younger. It was thought that, you know, the brain damage that she sustained then was all, you know, healed and it was fine. But the cyst was a sign that there was still something not going well. It was on the parietal lobe, which is just behind the frontal lobe. And again, absolutely crucial for so many actions that we do. It is, in particular, we know that it's responsible for the kind of body schema that we have, that we instinctively know, you know, all our limbs, where they are, what we're doing, how we move them. And of course, this is often referred to as the alien limb syndrome or alien hand syndrome, as if, you know, it's not my hand. It's
a bit like Dr. Strangelove choking himself.
Very, very much like that. I think you're probably inspired by this.
I thought what was also interesting was that he explains that not only does it tell us where our body is in space, but if we happen to be holding a tool, it tells us also where that tool is. And I was wondering whether this was also the case for you know, when you're driving your car, sometimes it feels as if the car is an extension of yourself. You know, after a while, you know exactly how much distance between you and the object that you have to pass.
This is sort of like an extended body schema.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I think that's the right way to look at it. And in this case, again, we have a happy ending, luckily, because the cyst could be removed. And she really was restored. Her body schema was there. The cyst was pressing on that part of the parietal lobe, which made her unaware of her leg and hand on one side. So,
but it not only gave back the ability for her to know where her body was, but also, most importantly for her, she could go back to dancing because her hands and legs didn't behave autonomously, without her volition.
Yes. It is very interesting that she had to control her alien hand by looking at it constantly.
Yes.
As soon as she lost attention, and I think it took 20 seconds, that's for the loss of attention, the hand was doing its own thing.
And that was also interesting to me because also what happened was, if her hand was there but something touched it, her hand would automatically grab it, which of course is extremely difficult if it happens to be another person.
Yes, indeed. So again, the sort of social implications of all these difficult consequences of brain damage are very strongly highlighted. You know, in all these cases, you can see this. And in this case, that was actually the main gain in the end, that she could integrate again.
It's fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because obviously one of the things this book tells us, going back to the question that was asked initially, what makes us who we are, it tells us that it's our brain. And we are no more than our brain. And all of these people underwent a change in both their social and personal identities as a consequence of changes in what was happening in the brain. So Descartes is not right. There isn't a mind and a brain, which are completely separate.
Yep,
the two are intimately linked.
Yeah.
But what was interesting was he also said that this this awareness of self, this concept of self, does not seem to be located in a particular bit of the brain. It is sort of distributed.
Yeah, that's very, that is indeed an insight from neuroscience. It was not necessarily what we expected. But you can look at all these different conditions, very different losses of structure and function. And the self is, in some sense, still present. It is the brain can, to some extent, compensate for these great losses. Also, it is the self is changed very often, and it is as if you have a particular map, a representation of who you are, where sometimes bits can be just missing. They're not there anymore, but the map is still there. However deconstructed it is. That is really an interesting insight. And of course, it doesn't make it any easier to understand how we get there, how we get from brain to mind.
But it's actually also interesting and encouraging, I think, to know that the brain is rather plastic and actually can grow. It's not as if we set off with a particular number of brain cells and a particular number of connections between them. Well, we can grow areas of the brain, as in the famous taxi driver story, where taxi drivers who learnt the knowledge increased their hippocampus.
Yes. yes, we know that there is a lot of plasticity, and not just in early ages. We can have that at all times. But what's particularly plastic, I think, about us is that we're not just isolated items and elements. We are in the context of other people. We relate to other people, and they shape us. So we also adapt to particular groups that we like to belong to. And that's actually another really important theme of the book, that you cannot suppress this strong tendency to belong. It just makes evolutionary sense. We couldn't survive on our own. We need others. Not just our close family, but we have other identities. We have, we are part of groups and not part of other groups. So this is called in-group versus out-group. And Masoud Hussein is an extremely sensitive insights to what it means to be an immigrant to another culture, another society. So I think three of the seven patients were from other cultures and had adapted and assimilated, but he himself came as a young child from Bangladesh to Birmingham, I think, and he grew up in England, and he's acutely aware of how he had to adapt and assimilate, and it resonates with me because, of course, I came from Germany, and you could say it's also a rather different culture, and I can also very strongly see how this process of belonging to particular in groups is something that can be changed. You can adapt, and other people can adapt to you, and it is an ongoing process.
So the last thing I would probably ask is, obviously this is a book which is good for everybody. I think it is beautifully written, very compassionately written, telling these wonderful stories. What would you say was the most interesting thing you learnt from the book, and what would you advise people to read it for?
I think it throws really new light on how we fit into society and what the brain has got to do with it. And you will learn about the brain by reading this, and will find completely new knowledge represented. And really, I thoroughly recommend it.
Thank you to my guest, Professor Dame Uta Frith. The book we have been discussing is Our Brains, Ourselves by Masoud Hussein, published by Canongate Press in 2025. You can catch up with more suggestions for a good science read on our podcasts, which can be found on the Oxford University website or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.